You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Pipefitters, Local 533, and the International Association of Firefighters, Local 42. The Greater Kansas City Firefighters, Local 42, is an affiliate of the International Association of Firefighters. We are your firefighters, EMS professionals, communication specialists, prevention and logistical support members within the Greater KC Metro region. We support labor and labor education that is provided by this program, and we thank them for that. And the Pipefitter powers the engines of industry that keep business thriving in America. They install, maintain, and service any system that involves air conditioning, heating, chemicals, or refrigeration in residential, commercial, or industrial buildings, as well as high-tech clean rooms. We thank our underwriters for their support to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, we are celebrating Heartland Labor Forum's 30th anniversary this week on the air with something old and something new. The old is our first show. It's about the Eastern Airlines strike 30 years ago. The new is a talk with railway workers about a fresh corporate strategy called precision railroading, which some workers say puts profits ahead of safety. And now we're going to have a big celebration, so I don't know, what is it, happy birthday?
Yay!
I'm Judy Ansel, and we've got a studio full of old and new also volunteers. And sitting next to me here is Bill Claus, one of the founders of the Heartland Labor Forum. Hey, Bill.
That makes me one of the old, right?
You're an old. And then we have a medium here, Tino Scalisi from United Auto Workers.
Hello, everybody.
How long you been with the show?
Well, I've been with the show since 2006, I think, was my very first interview.
You're fairly old.
I'm fairly old.
Okay. And then, come on up you
I
guys.
I should also say I'm also on disciplinary action from Ford Motor Company right now.
Oh, why do you want to say that?
I don't know. I just felt like...
What else is new?
Nothing else
All right.
is new.
And we have Christina Hendricks, Dismang.
And Ben... With the show, it's almost 3 years now, going over a little 3 years since I've been on the show, so I'm part of the new.
You're pretty new, yeah. And she's a member of AFT, American Federation of Teachers. And then we got Chris Mann.
Hello.
Also a member of the American Federation of Teachers. How long have you been in this show?
I moved here in 2008. Joined the show probably about 2010, so it makes me medium person.
Ooh, yeah, you're pretty
9 years.
All right, and then walking up to the mic is Lon Swearingen. Lon, how long have you been with the show?
Well, I'm here because of AFT, but also the statewide Independent Living Council.
He's representing the interests of both labor and the disabled, he's done a great job of bringing us some shows about disability rights. And finally, we have, well, not finally, because we also have Jen.
Hello, Jeff.
And we got Jeff, right. We have Tom Gepkin, who is our newest volunteer.
Probably a couple months in.
And so we got the old, we got the new, and then we've got Jen, our engineer.
Yeah, I don't know. I started in 2013, so I'm like
that's quite
new,
a while.
New, yeah, I say low medium.
She's an adolescent.
She has been a part of a long line of people who have engineered this show, starting with Jack Hedrick, who you're going to hear in our Eastern Airlines show. He's the announcer. Jack Hedrick was a member of the Ford Local 249, vice president, and he was also a board member here at KKFI. And I remember hauled our dish up to the roof of the building on Westport. He engineered all of that, too. And then we had Karen Wright, and then we had John Todd, and we had Weber Kusuma, and now we have Jen.
No, I took over after John Todd.
You took over after
yeah,
John
yeah,
Todd.
Yeah.
Weber came before John.
Yep.
Right. And then on the phone, let's hear from him. We got Jeff Humfeld.
I am here.
Hi, Jeff.
It's a baseball game.
So did the Royals win?
Well, they got started about 2 hours late, but they are up 1-0 in on top of the fifth. So.
Oh, great. Well, thanks for calling in. And when did you get involved in the Heartland Labor Forum? It was a long time ago.
Yeah, it was about 1994, I believe.
Uh-huh.
I've kind of lost track, but I remember we were going to Illinois more than once.
Oh, for the Staley strike.
Yeah.
Yeah, we covered that
Staley
thing like crazy, yeah.
Situation.
Okay.
So,
other memories of Heartland Labor Forum, of what you did?
I think one of the things that was most important to me was that it gave me an opportunity to do some things that I couldn't do within my own union. In other words, you know, be more active and interact with more people in different unions and with the movement as a whole. And I think that was probably the most important part of being able to be on the air.
Oh, that's really good. I mean, we consider ourselves to be part of the labor movement, which means we have a lot of different unions involved and a lot of different working people, and bringing them together makes a movement, right?
It does.
Yeah. Bill, what's your favorite? Do you have a favorite memory, or do you have an unfavorite memory?
Well, I think my favorite memory probably is interviewing Pete Seeger.
Oh, right.
Which has been quite some time ago now, so and actually I came across a cassette of that and got to listen to it maybe sometime a few months ago.
How'd you do?
Well, I thought I did just fine. I don't know, and I did have a great fun during the early days of writing the Wild Bill's Wide World of Workers Culture. It gave me a chance to just be a smart aleck about all kinds of things, and so that was a lot of fun.
Great, that's cool. You got a favorite memory?
I do have a favorite memory. So I first started at Ford Motor Company in 1999, and I got involved with the started taking classes with Judy at the Institute for Labor Studies, a project of UMKC and local labor unions, and I did my first show in 2006. But I think that my favorite show. One of my favorite shows. I did one with Vinnie Sorrentino, one of the leaders of the rank and file leaders of Ford Motor Company at the Kansas City Assembly Plant, who is at this time having a heck of a time at Ford Motor Company. So, Vinnie, if you're listening, hello, all the other guys from the loop. But I think that one of my favorite shows was when you interviewed Ed Asner.
Ed Asner, yeah.
Another, he was a temporary, he was an auto worker.
Very briefly.
Very, very briefly an auto worker. But so my favorite memory from that is that they were recording in the studio for Ed Asner, and his daughter and I were in the green room, and we were yucking it up, and she was talking about him having to do, Ed Asner was having to do something with, like, a Santa Claus. He had a big beard, so he just got done doing the Santa Claus movie. We were so loud, his daughter and I.
I remember
this too.
Is Ed Asner went to the glass and
he interrupted the interview.
Yes. Yeah,
he said, "Just a minute, stop the tape."
Yeah. And then
he pounded on the window.
Yeah, pounded on the window and
it's like, "Shut up."
I can't say what Ed Asner said, but he said in no uncertain terms, in an absolute Lou voice from Mary Tyler Moore, that I needed to stop.
He was Lou Grant.
He was done. He was done with me and my talking.
And that was the very first show I ever engineered for you guys.
You're kidding.
That was my very first. That was my very first interview I ever engineered. And excuse me, I was apprenticing with John at the time. And yeah, I mean, talk about baptism by fire.
Yeah, he was a real character.
You know, we had Bill Grigsby on any number of times too.
Oh yeah,
he's one that you had to watch very. His best, oh yeah, it was best recording him ahead of time. Because he had the pretty salty language most of the time, yeah.
Right.
Although, you know, of course, as a radio personality himself, he knew not to say it on the air. But he would kind of go off into the side road sometimes when you're doing an interview ahead of time.
I'll tell you, one of my favorite or unfavorite memories was when there was almost a fist fight between an editorial writer from the Kansas City Star and the head of the ATA, the Transportation Authority, over privatization. These guys got into such a fight on the air that we had, as soon as the interview was over, they went out in the hall and we had to pull them apart.
What, was that Javier?
No, that wasn't Javier. It was that manager of the ATA.
Oh, okay.
And Tom McClanahan, who was an right-wing editorial writer for the Kansas City Star. It was hilarious. We got to go. Chris, did you want to say something?
I just wanted to say that everybody's bringing up famous people that we have contact with.
Uh-huh.
But I wanted to highlight the really famous people are the striking workers of our country who have stepped out and stepped up to change our society for the better.
Right. Absolutely right. And Chris has been diligent about reporting on those strikes, especially the teacher strikes.
Teacher strikes, yeah.
And kept everybody abreast of what's going on around the country. And thank you all for making this 30 years the best volunteer experience of my life. And now you're going to hear our first show.
This is the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, features, music, culture by and for union members and anyone who works. The views expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect positions of any of the unions or colleges involved, or of KKFI.
Strength of one, but the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever.
Union, yes.
Union, yes.
Lorenzo, no.
Lorenzo, no.
Eastern stays.
Eastern stays.
Lorenzo, go.
Lorenzo, go.
Today, our first show is about the strike by machinists against Eastern Airlines and its chairman, Frank Lorenzo, which has now been going on for 4 weeks. The news media's coverage of this strike illustrates an important reason why we believe Heartland Labor Forum is necessary. Nowadays, very few newspapers, radio, or TV stations have reporters who exclusively cover labor. There used to be many. As a result, labor and workers in general get very little coverage. When they are covered, it is usually by a business reporter who is not real familiar with unions or the point of view of working people. Of course, major strikes usually get covered, especially if there is any violence involved. The more violence, the more coverage. Since the Eastern strike has been completely peaceful, the news media seems to have lost interest rather quickly. It's ironic that Polish unions often get bigger headlines than do American unions.
Except for a few labor or independent papers and public radio and TV, the media is in business to make a profit. They depend for their profits on advertising often purchased by our employers. Needless to say, the silence of the media on speed-ups, safety issues, or runaway shops serves both their interest and the interest of their business advertisers. When union members fight to protect a standard of living, which is nothing compared to Frank Lorenzo's, the media often depict them as stubborn, old-fashioned, or not in tune with the new competitive age.
Besides that, the public is never us. Take the Eastern strike as an example. In the first days after the strike began, as Alexander Cockburn pointed out in last week's Nation magazine, the public was gravely inconvenienced, he said. Who was this public? They were, according to Cockburn, interviewed at airports intended to be traveling to Florida for the family's first vacation in 21 years on tickets purchased by the accumulated life savings of the grandmother. The public does not include, he said, the families of the 4,000 machinists thrown out of work by Lorenzo when he shut down the Kansas City hub last September.
The story we will tell today is an attempt to show why the Eastern strikers are fighting in the public interest. It is a story of years of sacrifice by workers to keep a company afloat despite management's attempt to destroy it and the union. It is a story of creative leadership, an educated and involved union membership, and a story of solidarity in the workplace which extends to the entire labor movement.
A sign of this solidarity could be seen at the March 19th rally at KCI, sponsored by the Heart of America AFL-CIO, where 1,500 area unionists from at least 50 unions rallied in support of the Eastern strikers. Harry Spring, Executive Secretary of the Labor Council, introduced the rally and rehearsed its chants.
And that we don't like Frank Lorenzo. We don't like the type of treatment Frank Lorenzo has given our brothers and sisters that work at Eastern. We're here to stand in support of our courageous brothers from the machinists, from the pilots, and from TWU for their willingness to stand up to this robber baron and tell him enough is enough.
How have labor relations at Eastern gotten to the point that the 8,500 mechanics, ramp servicemen, and related employees in Machinist District 100 felt that they had no choice but to risk their family's livelihood by striking, despite Frank Lorenzo's threat to declare bankruptcy?
It's Nick Angeles. I'm a ramp serviceman. I've been with Eastern for 10 years. I came here to open the station up 4 years ago, and now I've been laid off because of what Frank Lorenzo has done to this company. They talk about family affair. To give you an idea, my dad has been with the company for 31 years. I've been 10 and my brother's 6, so that's been 47 years of family affair with this company. And it's not fair what this man does to bleed this company. He's doing the same thing to Eastern that he did to Continental.
And why have other Eastern employees, the pilots and flight attendants, agreed and refused to cross the machinist picket lines? Why is Lorenzo so hated? And why is he apparently dismantling Eastern Airlines, which in 1979 was the world's number one airlines in number of passengers carried and productivity? Herb Johnson, president of Machinist Local 1650, addressed the rally.
What we have here today is a continuation of a 100-year legacy of working men and women in trade unions, free trade unions, under the banner of the AFL-CIO, repudiating the kind of slime and sleaze that this man, Frank Lorenzo, represents. Beyond that, we're just glad everyone turned out, and we know we're not just here for the very just struggle for the Eastern Airline IAM and ALPA and flight attendant workers on Eastern Airlines. We're here for every working man and woman in this country who says, Frank, you're too far over the line. And that's the end of it.
Problems with management are not a new thing at Eastern. For years, from 1938 to 75, under the chairmanship of World War I flying ace Eddie Rickenbacker, who ran the airline like the military, there were scores of strikes and slowdowns, but the union had won contracts which provided for a standard of living higher than in most industries. In 1975, former astronaut Frank Borman took over as CEO. Eastern announced impending bankruptcy that year and succeeded in getting the unions to agree to concessions worth $80 million. By 1976, they showed a profit.
Despite this, Borman again came to the unions in 1977 and asked for further concessions. The result was called the Variable Earnings Program, or VEP, a five-year return of 3.5% of workers' wages per year. It was disguised as a profit-sharing plan. In 5 years, workers lost over $100 million, which was more than the total value of Eastern stock.
In 1978, airline deregulation pushed down ticket prices as over 100 new non-union airlines entered the market. Older airlines, like Eastern, often had to fly at a loss. Borman, in order to counter high energy prices and meet the competition, started to buy new, fuel-efficient planes. Between 1980 and 83, he spent $1.4 billion on 25 A300 and 27 Boeing 757s, gambling that energy costs would rise. They dropped, and Eastern was left with a debt of $2.5 billion. Losses mounted, and by 1983, there were a staggering $183 million.
As the crisis unfolded, the machinists did not stand by idly. In 1980, the membership elected Charles Bryan as new president of District 100 on a platform promising to end the VEP. Bryan believed that the union needed expertise to analyze intentionally misleading company financial data.
Already, some Eastern Union leaders had researched the company pension fund and found manipulation of data that saved the company millions. Research disclosed that assets were being reallocated from the machinist to the pilot's pension fund and that the manager of their pension fund was Prudential Life, which had financed construction of the National Right to Work Committee building in Virginia.
Research findings like this were systematically shared with the membership and generated popular demands in the 1981 negotiations for joint control of the pension plan. Borman, in negotiations and in frequent videos played to captive audiences of workers, demanded continuation of the VEP. He said high labor costs and competition from non-union airlines like Delta were causing Eastern's problems. The union countered with research which showed Eastern workers to be far more productive than Delta's. Eastern's troubles were caused by heavy debt, not competition from non-union airlines. Why, the union asked, had Eastern allowed the debt to grow so high?
They looked at the board of directors and found that 9 of the 16 members were from banking or financial institutions and that the Rockefeller family had significant representation on the board. Why were the banks so willing to keep lending money to Eastern? And why had Eastern continued to buy planes despite high interest rates, an economic downturn, and low passenger travel? They discovered that Boeing Aircraft Company was in deep trouble. It had a heavy debt and needed to sell planes or it would go bankrupt. Who were Boeing's lenders? 12 of 18 were also Eastern lenders. The union concluded that the workers, through concessions, were subsidizing Eastern's bailout of Boeing in order to keep the banks who lent both of them money from taking huge losses. In many respects, Eastern workers were like the citizens of Mexico or Brazil, forced by the same banks to pay for loans, which they got no benefit from, just to keep the banks solvent.
As workers learned of this and contract negotiations stagnated, a war broke out at Eastern. Management and labor were each at each other's throats. Workers lowered productivity, absenteeism surged, and management disciplined heavily. Bryan, at a 1982 stockholders meeting, demanded a seat on the board as employee representative. He argued that since the employees were financing the company to the tune of $110 million in givebacks, and since all of Eastern's board were affiliated with banks and other institutions of the super rich and demonstrated only contempt for the workers, the employees' lack of representation was like that of the Patriots of 1776, who made a revolution over the issue.
In a video to the workers, Frank Borman argued that continuation of the 3.5% wage reduction would only mean the sacrifice of a few six-packs of beer a week. Union members countered with buttons picturing a can of beer labeled Frank's 3.5 beer. Deposit, no return.
The war continued until March 1983 when Borman, pressured by union solidarity and strike threats, as well as by his creditors, agreed to a new contract which gave the union a 17% wage increase over 3 years, equal control over any future employee involvement programs, partial joint control of the pension fund, increased job security, and a pledge to maintain the integrity of work rules. Borman said, this settlement could only be characterized as a rape.
But in the fall of 1983, a wave of concessions and demands rocked airline employees. In September, Continental Airlines owner Frank Lorenzo closed Continental and reopened using Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection to void his union contracts. He admitted at the time that it wasn't a problem of cash. Our sole problem was labor. Pilots and flight attendants joined machinists who were already on strike, but Lorenzo scaled back service, hired scabs, and cut pay by 50%. 2 days later, Frank Borman, in a video to Eastern employees, threatened to do the same thing unless they took a 20% wage cut. Again, the machinists countered with research, education, and mobilization. They, along with the pilots and flight attendants, pressured Borman to rescind the bankruptcy threat in exchange for concessions worth $292 million, productivity increases worth $75 million, 25% ownership of common stock, 4 seats on the board of directors, and an employee involvement plan which gave workers the right to determine the way work would be done. There were huge cost savings, and within 2 years, Eastern was recording the biggest profits in its history.
Then, amid new fare wars in late 1985 and rising losses, Borman again blamed problems on high labor costs and demanded 20% more in wage cuts. The whole employee involvement program came crashing down. Frank Lorenzo came courting, and in February 1986, as the machinists refused to choose between pay cuts and Lorenzo, the company was sold. Lorenzo bought Eastern for $620 million. It was a steal. He even got Eastern to borrow over half the money to finance its own sale. Despite the fact that Eastern labor costs were less than the industry average, Lorenzo knew he'd have to lower them in order to pay off Eastern's catastrophic level of debt. When he kicked the union members off the board of directors, laid off 2,000, installed TV surveillance, and threatened 50% wage cuts, the union found itself back in the midst of all-out war.
Lorenzo represents the new era of corporate raiders, reminiscent of robber barons like Jay Gould, who monopolized railroads 100 years ago. Lorenzo's Texas Air Corporation, now owner of Continental and Eastern, is the largest airline in the Western world. It has 20% of the world market. Lorenzo busted the unions at Texas Air and then at Continental. Eastern machinists believe that's why he always intended to do to them. Today, Lorenzo is demanding 20 to 50% cuts in wages and benefits from machinists.
Nick Wink, vice president of IAM Lodge 561, which represents the 31 Eastern machinists in Kansas City, shared his views with us in this March 19th interview with Bill Claus. Bill asked Wink why Borman agreed to the March 1983 agreement, which gave substantial power to the workers, seats on the board of directors, and the right to reorganize the work.
A couple of questions. First of all, Frank Borman has had the reputation of being a very authoritarian leader. Do you know why he would agree to such a program to give that kind of power to the employees?
Well, you were right. He was that type of leader. He was not necessarily a businessman. And people in business knew that this product could be developed as far as a working together program, and they were willing to take advantage of that. And they saw then that the unions were right with their ideas and were willing to work with us and in a way force Mr. Borman to go along with this situation.
I guess the thing that really intrigues me as part of the labor community is this aspect of the workers being able to organize how they work and trying to find ways of ending waste and that sort of thing. That sort of thing was in the agreement that you had. There's been different experiences in different parts of labor. How did this arrangement work for you guys?
Oh, it worked great. We were saving the company all kinds of money. Everyone knows in all parts of labor that if you really want the best ideas, you have to go to the man that's doing the job. And that's exactly what they did, and we did show a profit with that.
So what else was the result of this, what would you call it, management labor cooperation?
Yes, we called it an employee involvement program, and with it, we were able to save the company over $100 million. We were able to show a profit that was probably the highest in Eastern's history in the first two quarters of 85.
Well, if this arrangement saved the company so much money, what happened to it? Why isn't it still around?
Well, by the fall of 85, I'm not positive and I can't prove it, but I believe Mr. Lorenzo might have already indicated he was going to try to buy this company. The company at that time took a whole different view of our arrangement. They didn't like what was working so well. They were not getting the credit for the company earning the money. It was the employees that were getting the credit, and I guess that's not suitable to management.
Crucial to the strikers' ability to shut down Eastern has been the refusal of the pilots represented by the Airline Pilots Association, or ALPA, to cross the machinist picket line. Here, Eastern pilot Lee Johnson explains the pilots' support.
Okay, I'm with Eastern Airlines. My name is Lee Johnson, and I'm a captain on a 727. Been working with Eastern 22 and a half years, I'm sorry.
Well, why are the pilots supporting Eastern on this strike?
Well, because we feel that we have to make some stand to get rid of this crummy management that we have that's taken our company, already taken them into bankruptcy. And We feel that if we don't support them, we're not going to have an airline of any type to work with. And we have to get people like him and his type out of the airline industry and let them go do something else somewhere else. That's essentially what it's all about.
It's clear that the pilot support and the enthusiastic support of the entire labor movement has been a surprise to Lorenzo. In this strike, labor has begun to recapture some of the solidarity which characterized earlier days. Many people at the March 19th rally expressed both an understanding of the significance of the Eastern strike for working people and a sense of optimism.
I'm Wally Waldrop. I'm with the Boilermakers. I'm polite. I'm proud and delighted to be here today to see the unity and brotherhood exhibited by my brothers and sisters. We've not seen this for some time. It always seems labor has to be down and being kicked before we ever get up and really show the unity that's really there.
Jerry Klein, Local 249. I think this is a great show of support for the Eastern strikers, and this is not just the machinist strike, but this is all our strike. It's good to see solidarity like this amongst all union brothers and sisters.
My name is Carrie Carrillo.
And can you tell me why you're out here today supporting the Eastern strikers?
Because their boss, Frank Lorenzo, wants to cut their wages down about $2 or $3, and they don't want him to, and they are not going to work until he gives them back their regular wages.
I'm Jerry Young from St. Joe, Local 460 Teamsters, and I'm down here just to help out the machinists.
My name is Beverly Amstutz, and my husband's a mechanic with TWA.
What do you think of the strike today? Or the
I think this walk is wonderful, and I think it's time that the people get together, and I think they should have done it a long time ago. Because people have suffered, and it's time that we all stick together if we want to get anything done that's right.
I'm proud to be out here to walk in a picket line. I can't believe the overwhelming support that we've gotten from all the labor council and every other union that's out here today with us walking this picket line.
Okay, we're talking with Harry Spring, Secretary Treasurer of the Heart of America Labor Council. Mr. Spring, how did you feel the rally went today?
I think it was a great show of support and solidarity for our brothers and sisters at Eastern.
Okay, can you tell us how important this Eastern strike is for the rest of the labor movement?
I believe this is the strike of this decade. This is the strike that's going to turn the corner for the labor movement to say we're tired of these robber barons demanding give back so they can line their pockets with silver coins. And we're saying, no, we want our fair share.
At the rally, UAW Region 5 Director Jerry Tucker also commented on the significance of this strike.
It's time. I can tell you that we've gone through a decade where workers in this country have felt a sense of lost power and the need to bring together the various unions and the various working people around these kind of struggles is an acute need today. That's the only way we're going to stop a decade of decline that's occurred for all of us.
Part of that is in part to the Reagan administration. We lost that fight against the PATCO 8 years ago. I think this is now why everyone's starting to join the bandwagon and see if we can test the waters of the Bush administration.
Well, I think it's not only just an analysis of the politics. There's no question that the Reagan administration has been disastrous for working people, the standard of living, the quality of life for us. But this effort now is coming up from the ranks of the membership of unions and also from other working people in this country. Even if they don't belong to a union, they want something done to restore some power to the wage earners of this country. And it's not just a case of those of us who have positions of responsibility, but it's a case of the membership of the unions are joining into this thing and bringing it up and are demanding we do this type of effort in behalf of people in trouble.
Some closing observations. The December 1983 agreement establishing employee involvement had interesting results. This short-lived experiment in workers' democracy proved that when workers are given power, real power, on the job, morale and productivity soars. Jobs were reorganized more efficiently and effectively, and they found ways of cutting costs by $100 million. This disproves the oft-heard lie that unions are only interested in more money. Remember, these improvements in cost efficiency were made by the workers in spite of wage concessions. Then along came Frank Lorenzo, and this successful experiment was abandoned, replaced by demands for even more wage concessions. Eastern, so typical of companies gained by junk bond finance leverage buyouts, the real Reagan legacy, is drowning in a sea of red ink. Finally, a tip of the solidarity cap to the pilots at Eastern, whose show of unity with the IAM was instrumental in shutting this anti-worker corporation down.
Next week on Heartland Labor Forum, we will look into the threatened 5% wage cut for Kansas City, Missouri city workers and the new plan to restructure the role of teachers in the Kansas City, Missouri school district. Today's program was done by Bill Kloss of AFGE Local 1336, Judy Ansel of the Institute for Labor Studies, with production assistance by Jim Foster of IBEW Local 124 and John Wright, Millrice Local 1529. The Institute for Labor Studies conducts courses for union members, staff, and officers, as well as the general public on a variety of subjects. Arbitration, taught by Dave Alexander of the George Meany Center, will run from April 10th through the 14th. And on May 8th, we will present a one-day program on handling media interviews. Call 765-9996 to register or for further information.
Did you know that more than 100,000 workers die each year from job-related injuries and disease? On April 28th, Kansas City will be one of six cities in the U.S. to host Workers' Memorial Day. On this day, we will mourn the dead and fight for the living by supporting better laws and enforcement to protect workers' health and safety. There will be a rally at noon, April 28th, at Barney Ellis Plaza, 13th and Wyandotte, downtown. Join us.
This has been the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, features, music, culture by and for union members and anyone who works. This program is put on by volunteers from the AFGE Local 1336, the IBEW Local 124, UAW Local 249, Millwrights Local 1529, SEIU Local 96, and the Bakers Union Local 218. It is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies, a joint project of the UMKC and Longview Community College. One show per month is sponsored by the Heart of American Labor Council and the Missouri State Labor Federation, AFL-CIO. The views expressed in the Heartland Labor Forum do not necessarily reflect the position of any of the unions or colleges involved or of KKFI. We want our listeners' response and input. If your union has news or announcements of events, we'll put it on the air. You can call us at 765-9996 or 454-6333. This is Jack Hedrick saying thanks for listening.
KKFI is the Kansas City area's independent, non-commercial community radio station. We seek to stimulate, educate, and entertain our audience, to reflect the diversity of the local and world community, and to provide a channel for individuals and groups, issues and music that have been overlooked, suppressed, or underrepresented by other media. Interested in volunteering? Contact 816-994-7864 or go online at kkfi.org and click the volunteer tab. Thank you for listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
And hi, this is Judy Ansel again. We live in an era of deregulation. The current scandal over the Boeing faulty airplane guidance systems is a direct result. Somewhere back around Reagan, Republicans got the idea that business was interested in self-policing. That is, that we could rely on them to honestly tell us when they were violating regulations and cutting corners to make a bigger profit. That idea even spread to the Democrats. Today, whether you eat or breathe or wear clothes, you are exposed to the results of deregulation through self-regulation. You don't even have to fly. You can take it if you take a train, if you work on a train, if you live within a few miles of a train, you too are put at risk because of deregulation. Here in Kansas City, which is the second largest rail hub in the country, we're all at risk, and the people who face it every day are the experts on it, and they are the rail workers. Tonight on the show, we've got four of them. They all work for Union Pacific in different jobs, some in the shop, some on the trains. They're going to talk about a program the UP, that's the Union Pacific, is implementing called Precision Railroading, and they're going to talk about deregulation. We'll find out what it is and what our government is doing to regulate it. So here in the studio, we have Matt, who is a member of the IBEW. We have Will, who's a member of the Machinist Union. We have Kelly, who's a member of UTU Smart. And on the phone from Iowa, we have a member of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, whose name is going to be Blett. In fact, none of these guys is using their real name because there is such a thing on the railroad as retaliation. And I really praise them for wanting to come on and tell their story. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judy.
And are you there in Des Moines?
I'm here. Thank you.
Okay. Well, welcome to you, too. So I want to start with something that's going to get the attention of our Kansas City folks. We have tons and tons of freight moving through our rail yards here day and night. Can you introduce us to what's on those trains? Who wants to tell us?
Well, basically, the nastiest chemicals and products you can ever imagine are transported by rail. The
like?
Most horrific chemicals, for instance, explosive materials like ethanol, chlorine, lots of inhalation hazards, stuff that if they were to derail on a train would literally wipe out whole communities.
How far away or how close do you have to live to be at risk?
Depending on the chemical and the wind direction, you could be as close as a mile. You could be 15 miles away, depending on the amount of product.
So, really?
Yes.
Have we ever had an accident like that here in the Kansas City area where chemicals were spilled? Or?
We've been very fortunate. We have had leaks, but we have not had the horrendous accidents that we've seen around the country and across North America.
What about nuclear waste? Does that come through here?
Yes, it does.
Frequently?
More times than people would want to believe.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. Why don't each of you tell us what kind of work you do on the railroad? Let's start with you from the locomotive engineer in Iowa.
Yeah, I think you summed it up just based on the title. I'm a locomotive engineer. So my job would be what people might call driving the train, although we don't really drive. We operate a train. So my job when I go into work is to make sure that train runs its route as safely and hopefully as efficiently as it can. But with the focus being on safety. You mentioned, has anything ever happened before? I think it's important to bring up the topic of Lac-Mégantic about 6 years ago, a crude oil train with Bakken crude exploded and 47 people in the community of Lac-Mégantic, Quebec, were killed in that tragedy. And so there's a prime example of something where it could happen in any community in North America.
Yeah, and we're going to be talking more about that next week on the show, actually. We're going to have the author of a book that has just been published about that tragedy here talking about that. So if this show doesn't scare you, maybe that one will, although we hope people do something about it. Let me say that the man you just heard from is also a member of Railway Workers United, as are two of the other people here in the studio, Matt and Will. And do you want to tell us real briefly what Railway Workers United is?
I'll jump in here again. Railroad Workers United, Cross-Craft Coalition of Railroad Workers. So one of the things about the rail industry, as with many other industries, is that they're divided up by craft unions. And on the railroad, there's about 13 different unions that represent railroad workers. And so Railroad Workers United is an attempt to bring members of those unions together in one conversation, fighting the problems that we're having against railroad carriers across the board.
Okay, thanks. Okay, let me go to you, Kelly. Tell us what you do on the railroad.
Well, I'm a conductor, so I'm the one that gets on the ground and does all the work. Whenever there's an issue with any of the cars, I take care of that. While we're moving across the road, I'm up in the engine with the locomotive engineer supervising and assisting him and on the lookout for any hazards or issues that may occur.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Will, how about you?
I work in the diesel shop, and it's our job to inspect and maintain the engines and to make sure that everything is able to pull freight down the rail safely. Unfortunately, that's not always the case.
Okay. And Matt?
I'm an electrician, so I'm responsible for all the electrics on the train and just making sure that along with the machinist, it makes horsepower and that it's defect-free.
Okay. All right. So you see all aspects of railroading between the four of you. So, you know, scaling back on personnel has been going on for decades. I did a quick look on the internet, and I found that there were 2 million railroad workers back in 1920, 100 years ago. Today there are 105,000, and most of them are not working on trains. They're doing other things that have to be done to make the railroad run. So, what is a typical crew today? How many people are there on a train?
Well, currently on trains on Union Pacific, there's a locomotive engineer and a conductor.
Two people?
Yes.
That's it.
And they currently would like to even go down to one or zero when technology allows them to do it.
So are they pushing now for one-man trains?
They have been trying to get the unions to agree to that.
Uh-huh.
And they are pushing for deregulation at the national level of the Railway Labor Act so they can get into that.
Okay, so they're regulated on how many people they have on the train now?
Well, currently we have crew consist agreements, and the protections of that crew consist agreement are only in place until the last pre-85 conductor stays employed. Once he retires, that opens up the crew consist agreement to be renegotiated.
Is it safe to have two people, let alone one person, on a train, running a train?
Ungodly, no. In no way is it safe. Oftentimes, our schedules are so sporadic. Our calls are sporadic. We oftentimes don't even know when we're going to work. So we're fatigued, and we're out there running exhausted and doing this work. And it's a danger to the public to even think about going down to one-person crews or less.
Okay. Either Matt or Will, you guys work in a shop. Are you working long hours? Are there enough workers in those shops? Or are there things, because, you know, I'm just thinking about the Boeing plane issue and how it's been said that Boeing was trying to meet the competition by, you know, rushing through the production of that aircraft. I can't remember the number of it. And so I'm wondering, do you get similar kinds of pressures on your job?
Oh, most definitely. There's a constant pressure of production on the shop floor. Basically, the old adage of the work speed up, more with less, is the name of the game. And it usually ends up being management and supervisors canceling and deferring safety items from being properly repaired and just sending them back out.
Kelly?
Judy, if I may, one other thing to add to that is oftentimes when we get on our train, the engineer and I, sometimes we'll find defects in those locomotives that are against the federal railway standards. And we're often harassed and rushed in an effort to get us out of town. They don't want to fix these things. They want us just to leave, no matter the condition. And that's a big problem.
You sent me a report about a rail disaster that took place in Iowa where a train carrying chemicals derailed, and there was an explosion. And, I mean, does that fit what you're talking about?
That's exactly. Just a different department in this case where you have the track maintenance being not adequately being inspected or maintained to federal standards. And as a result, it's part of the cause of that derailment where all that ethanol leaked into the waterways.
Okay. Well, okay.
If I can add, Judy, sure. I'm pretty familiar with that accident, and it was definitely something that having two people on that train helped avert even more tragedy or even more cars catching fire and potentially exploding. Because they had a two-person crew, they were able to cut away the cars that were not on fire from that train, and it's something that we call a deep blue train, which means it had a locomotive on both the front and the back of the train, so they were also able to then put to the rear of the train and pull even more cars away. So because the actions of that crew having two people, they were able to keep that train from catching fire and potentially exploding and causing an even bigger mess than what it did. And it's worth noting that could happen in any of our communities, whether it be rural Iowa or Des Moines or Kansas City. That could happen in a populated area today, and we're the first line of defense in preventing things from happening, or when they do happen, in responding to it.
Well, that sounds like a really great example of why you need at least two-man crews. So who wants to explain to me what the UP's concept of precision railroading is?
Basically, it's strip away what the company and the shareholders perceive as waste, and run the company as bare bones as possible to maximize profits. And that includes storing as much power as possible so they don't have any extra power sitting around in case they have failures or need to pull more trains. Also, the lack of manpower and people physically there to inspect and maintain things properly. They've been laying people off. Like Kelly said, it's coming down to the point where it's harassment and intimidation to try to get guys to just sign off on things and allow it to run so they can pull freight and try to make as much money as possible.
Well, this sounds to me like what in manufacturing was called lean production. It's the Japanese model. It's the Toyota model, where you strip away all the cushions in the system in order to constantly be stressing the system in order to be able to make the maximum amount of profits. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yes. Now think about what you just said, stressing the system. When you're stressing the system and we're carrying these hazardous materials, that's a problem.
Yeah.
And it's going to continue to be a problem. These accidents are just the beginning. There will be many more.
Dire prediction there.
It's very similar to that, and we've been doing that for a long time. The downsizing has occurred on the railroad over a period of time, but precision scheduled railroad really ramps that up, and it closes rail yards, it closes diesel maintenance facilities, it closes car repair facilities, and so there's not just less people, but there's even less places to do that needed maintenance. And less track maintenance. That's one thing we haven't gotten to as well. We rely on safe track to travel on in order to prevent derailments, and that is also being stressed as it was put.
That's. I wish we had somebody from the BMWE here to talk about that, but that's a whole other issue. Wow. Okay. So, how is your job affected by precision railroading?
As electricians, we have lost, and out on the run-throughs that we had men in place to inspect these engines to make sure they were FRA compliant. They've done away with all our run-through jobs and brought those guys back to the shops because they have a waiver to where an engine only has to be inspected by a qualified mechanic.
Is that a waiver from the government?
From the FRA.
That's the Federal Railroad Administration.
Right, where they only have to have a qualified mechanical inspector every 30 days now. So they got everybody back at the shop to where they're running these trains to where we don't even see them.
So now you have locomotive engineers inspecting trains daily that are not trained to the same standards as these professionals.
Right. They put them through a crash course of learning it, you know, just the basics, to mainly to where they don't see the problems. They don't know what to look at.
So the FRA is requiring less of the railroads. Are they doing the self-inspection kind of stuff? Is that what it is? They're policing themselves?
Oftentimes, yes.
What?
Yeah, right now on the railroad, you know, we'll call the FRA if we have willful violations, and that's when somebody knowingly signs off a known federal defect, and there's a whole book full of them. So we'll call the FRA, and right now they're really not doing a whole hell of a lot to stop or prevent these defects from running down the rails and pulling freight. And it's been said, you know, through rumors that right now the inspectors on the ground can't even write a violation without having their supervisor's approval. We've talked to supervisors that have said that that's not the case, but yet we haven't seen them in our facility write a single defect or write a violation.
Is this something that's just come down from the Trump administration, or does it predate Trump?
I would definitely say that it's gotten a lot worse since Trump's been in office.
Really?
But the fact of the matter is that ever since the railroads began, they've been too powerful to control.
And they're just as powerful. They used to be king. They're not as powerful as they used to be, are they?
They're very powerful.
They make billions of dollars a quarter. They've got quite a bit of power.
They buy lots of politicians.
Yeah. Okay.
Regardless of party.
Okay. Let me go back to the Lac-Mégantic disaster, because as our brother in Iowa was telling us, that is probably the worst rail disaster. Was it the worst rail disaster in history?
Oh. I guess I don't know my rail disaster history that well.
Oh, well, but, okay.
It was a pretty major one, and certainly one of the worst in recent memory.
Yeah, there were more than 100 people were killed, I believe. No?
47.
47, okay. The whole town was destroyed. And that was a one-man crew, wasn't it?
That's correct.
Okay, and he went to sleep because he had to sleep sometime, right? He was in the hotel.
True.
And the brakes failed.
Well, the engine caught on fire from deferred and lack of maintenance, and the dispatcher had requested that they set an X amount of handbrakes. Turns out all the tanker cars they were hauling and this volatile crude oil were overloaded, so they didn't even know the actual weight on these cars. They set the handbrakes, the engine catches on fire, the fire department shows up. The first thing they do is hit the e-stop button on the side to shut down the locomotive. Without the engine running and producing air pressure, all the air bleeds off, the brakes release, and it was on a pretty severe grade, and it rolled right down into this town where it derailed and leveled the town of Lac-Mégantic.
So, okay, so this was Canada. Why should we care? We don't have the same regulations as Canada, do we? Or lack of regulations?
Well, I think it's important to note that precision scheduled railroading started on the Canadian railroads. So it started with major Canadian railroads, and Hunter Harrison is a name that's synonymous with precision scheduled railroading. And
that was CSX?
Or Canadian Pacific and Canadian National are the two big railroads, and that's sort of the origination of precision scheduled railroading. And we certainly saw in Canada and continue to see train disasters because of the deregulation and the lack of enforcement, and so they've had to revisit what they're doing up there, and I think it's just a matter of time before that same thing happens here as we see precision scheduled railroading spreading to all the railroads in the United States as well.
Okay, well, that's all we have time for. I want to thank our brother engineer in Iowa. I want to thank Kelly and Matt and Will for being on the show, and I want to tell you that Bruce Campbell, the author of a book about the Log Megantic disaster, is going to be on the air next week on the Heartland Labor Forum. And he's also going to be speaking here in Kansas City on April 7th. Is that a Sunday?
It is.
Yeah. Okay. From 2 to 4 p.m. at Prospero's Books at 39th and Bell. So you can meet him. You can get a book. And if you want to get scared a little bit more, you can hear the whole story. Thank you guys very much for being on.
Thank you,
Judy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now we have the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. The new tenant organization of Kansas City Tenants has been forming, and they're meeting every week. And this coming Saturday, they're going to be having a mass canvas to build tenant power for the April 2nd city elections. If you'd like to volunteer, it's from 10:30 to 5 p.m. or anytime in between. You need to RSVP to Tara, T-A-R-A, at kctenants.org. And if you want a voter guide, go to bit.ly/kctenantvoter. There's a rally for $15 in a union with Boots Riley, the rap star and the film director, March 30th, 4:30 p.m. at Grove Park, East Truman Road and Benton Boulevard. This is sponsored by Stand Up KC. And then after that, at 6 o'clock, they're going to be screening Sorry to Bother You, the film by Boots Riley, from 7 to 9:30 at the Gem Theater. But you need to RSVP to Stand Up KC. The Bureau of Labor Statistics is having a BLS Data Users Conference on Prices and Employment Monday, April 1st, 9 a.m. to 12:30 at the Federal Reserve Bank in Kansas City. You can RSVP at BLS Info Kansas City at BLS.gov. That's it for tonight's show. You can find our calendar on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org. And I've already told you about next week's show. We're also going to be talking about the new labor caucus in the Missouri Democratic Party. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
For the coming.